You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Citizen. Isn't it time you saw the light? Citizen makes watches that are powered by light, any light, and will never need a battery. So stay on time with Citizen's collection of Echo Drive watches. They're for just about everyone who prefers to be on time. Visit citizenwatch.com/podcast for more. That's citizenwatch.com/podcast. In a world streamlined by technology, time really does fly. But what does that mean for its value? The new season of the podcast Outside the Box, presented by Walmart, explores this question exactly, with firsthand accounts from some of the most brilliant minds of today, like organizational psychologist Adam Grant, who spent his career carefully observing how people spend their time in the workplace. Hear about how Adam values his own work time and how he recommends we use ours. Outside the Box, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and everywhere you like to listen. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Imagine it's a rainy summer afternoon, and you're standing on the stone bridge that traverses Pennsylvania's Conemaugh River, watching that river quickly expand well beyond its banks. You knew your little steel town was prone to flooding, and you'd seen your share of it, but nothing like this. Then, you start to hear a deafening rumble, and suddenly upriver, you see what you can only describe as a huge hill rolling over and over. As it rapidly approaches you, you see earth, trees, train cars, the debris of hundreds of buildings, and miles of barbed wire heading straight for you. Before you even have time to think of finding shelter or running for higher ground, in the blink of an eye, you're dead. That was the scene on May 31st, 1889, as the narrow Conemaugh Valley was slammed with a 60-foot wall of water hurtling at 40 miles per hour, with a volumetric flow rate that temporarily equaled the average flow rate of the Mississippi River. It killed an estimated 2,209 people and left the modern-day equivalent of nearly $500 million in damage. To this day, the Johnstown flood remains one of the deadliest disasters in U.S. history, exceeded only by the 1900 Galveston hurricane and the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Now America's most famous weatherman and the co-host of The Today Show, Al Roker, tells the story of this living nightmare, those who caused it, and those who survived it in a gripping new book titled Ruthless Tide, The Heroes and Villains of the Johnstown Flood, America's Astonishing Gilded Age Disaster. Today, Al joins me on the podcast to give some idea of the magnitude and horror of the flood and describe the heroic recovery effort that made American Red Cross founder Clara Barton into a household name. He discusses how a disaster like Johnstown can actually bring people together and in time even becomes a badge of honor for whole communities. He talks about the elite country club that compromised the South Fork Dam and caused the flood, all so they could stock their lake for wealthy fishermen. He reveals some of the famous industrialists who belonged to that club and how they escaped justice for the Johnstown flood in a notorious trial that would ultimately lead to important changes in U.S. liability laws. Plus, Al Roker relates the lessons of the 1889 flood to global climate change and America's modern-day infrastructure needs. And then, in a lighter note, The self-described barbecue aficionado offers a few summer barbecue tips for the grill master in your family. Coming up with Al Roker in just a moment. Winner of 13 Emmys, Al Roker is the co-host and longtime weatherman on NBC's Today Show. He's authored many books, including the bestseller The Storm of the Century about the 1900 Galveston Hurricane, and now he follows it up with a no less compelling story called Ruthless Tide, The Heroes and Villains of the Johnstown Flood, America's Astonishing Gilded Age Disaster. Al Roker, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Ben. Nice to be here.
Now, your book, Ruthless Tide, comes out the same week as John McCain's book, The Restless Wave. Al, I kind of feel like you two really should have had a conversation about this. Are you worried folks might get a little confused?
Yeah, we should have, but I will defer to Senator McCain on any day. But the topics, I think, are different enough, and both – well, Senator McCain probably more known, well-known than me, but people will know enough. I hope they don't get them confused. If anybody does, I'll give them their money back.
Okay. Well, at the very least, you're a little bit less likely to get any angry tweets from the president when yours comes out, I assume.
One never knows.
You never know.
One never knows.
You're America's most famous weatherman, but I understand that you originally wanted to be a cartoonist growing up. So how did you find your calling as a weatherman?
It was by accident, actually. I was a sophomore at the State University of New York at Oswego. I had taken a television performance class, and my department chairman said, "You know, Roker, you've got the perfect face for radio." but this is the true story. But this is the same man who put me up for a weekend weather job toward the end of my sophomore year doing TV weather in Syracuse, New York at the CBS station. And I really had no interest in being on TV. I wanted to write or produce or do radio. I did not want to do television. And I got the job. And I thought, well, I'll just do this till I get a real job. And, 6 months after I got the job, then the weekday weatherman was let go. I got his job. And then 6 months after I graduated, I was in Washington, D.C., working at the Fox station there. Then it was Metro Media, Channel 5. And that's where I met Willard Scott, who really did change the arc of my career and my life. He mentored me and really took me under his wing. And I would not be doing what I'm doing today if it wasn't for Willard.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you still get those people who write hate mail to the weatherman if your prediction's off or it rains on their Saturday golf game?
Well, not so much anymore. Although, you know, you still do. With social media, it's almost a different tenor. I kind of miss the days where people called or wrote letters just about, you know, they were complaining about the forecast. Now it's just this vitriol and not everybody. Obviously, there are far more people who are lovely and are nice and want to engage in a conversation than these folks who just spew venom. But there's some days you look at it and you think, wow. I mean, were your parents that bad to you?
Well, now they can just yell at their smartphone, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, I do wonder, when everyone has an up-to-the-minute geo-targeted weather report available anytime right in the palm of their hand, do you think, Al, that there's still a place for the good old local weatherman, or might he one day go the way of J. Fred Muggs and TV variety shows?
You know, you bring up an interesting point, Ben, because I think while that's all well and good, and I've got a couple on my phone and my kids do, but those are basically – they are forecasts that are generated by algorithms and formulas. And I think people still come back to folks like wherever you're listening to this, your local weather person or your favorite network weather person, because we give you context. We give you some experience. We give you a human factor that an app can't give. And I still think, by and large, we will all exist in our spaces. But, I think that we are right now in a place where we still can exist, because I think people need us not so much for what we give, but how we give it.
Well, you've also parlayed your remarkable career in meteorology into two terrific books about extreme weather. Your previous book, The Storm of the Century, was about the 1900 Galveston hurricane, and now you have Ruthless Tide about the Johnstown flood. And what really puts all this in perspective for me is the fact that for a century, these two weather events, the Johnstown flood and the 1900 hurricane, were the deadliest disasters in U.S. history. It took 100 years, 9/11, 2001, for humans to devise a worse disaster than Mother Nature.
Yeah, and when it comes to, in a sense, a natural disaster, although this had a large component of man-made failure to it, but it was triggered by a natural event, it still is the greatest number of lives lost due to a flooding event in this country.
And it's fascinating to me how these weather events and other disasters like, say, the Chicago fire or the great San Francisco quake become part of the culture of the communities that get hit and come with a certain degree almost of bragging rights. I mean, my dad grew up in Galveston, Texas. He wasn't even alive in 1900, of course, but he loves to tell the stories of the hurricane. And when we go down there, he loves to point out how all the buildings have been razed after the storm. It really becomes a badge of honor for local like him. Why do you think that is? Is it just the triumph over adversity or what?
Yeah, I think you touched on it. It is a survivor's mentality of having survived something that nobody else did. I think it's also part of our DNA to be survivors and to tell those stories so that our children and our children's children don't forget. There were so many songs written about the Johnstown flood. There were several movies. There have been a number of books. I mean, David McCullough wrote perhaps the most definitive book out there back 20 years or 30 years ago. This we try to make a little different in that we try to tell some of the human stories about the people who survived the flood, folks who were perhaps responsible for the flood, and the aftermath and what grew out of it. I mean, the idea that a fledgling organization like the Red Cross and Clara Barton basically built their reputation, burnished their reputation on their response to the Johnstown flood. It was an amazing Herculean effort that she performed and her staff performed miraculously and brought a lot of comfort to folks who were suffering and lost everything.
Yeah, the 1889 Johnstown flood really makes for a gripping narrative. When did you first become interested in this story?
You know, it was I've always grew up in here in the Northeast. People have always talked about it, you know, the Johnstown flood. Watch out for the, you know, this is worse than the Johnstown flood. And of course, it wasn't, but that's the bar that, you know, has been set. And, you know, we did the first book, The Storm of the Century, and thinking about what's the next one? And I work with this terrific author and researcher, a guy named Bill Hoagland, who put all this research together. And we had a few topics, and he said, "I don't know. Even though this is back in the 1800s, it's still compelling to me." And when I started to lay stuff out, it was almost like a movie. I just was struck by the cast of characters, except these are real people and these are real lives. And I thought this is and I guess because I think part of it resonates today. You know, you had a group of wealthy individuals who wanted a club that they could go hunting and fishing. And so over the objections of others, the warnings of others, the criticism of others, they went ahead anyway and built, dammed up a river. It had been dammed once. They rebuilt that and really didn't take the care or the engineering expertise that needed to make sure that dam could be protected in the case of a catastrophic rainfall. And it was torpedoes be damned to the folks who live downriver and down in the valley. And, you know, I think that if we're not careful, we could be seeing a repeat of that in this day and age. Not so much a Johnstown flood, but I think environmental disaster is not something that we can't rule out at this point, because we're seeing a relaxation of our environmental laws, our zoning laws. If people are building bigger and bigger homes in places they not necessarily should be. And so I think that, again, while it probably won't be on the scope of a Johnstown flood, I think we are on the brink of probably another environmental disaster.
Yeah, there's so much of this book that seems applicable to the times that we're living in today, particularly at a time when the president is talking a lot about fixing what he calls America's crumbling roads and bridges and proposing, in some cases, privatization of those structures. Do you think what happened with the dam and the South Fork Hunting and Fishing Club might be a cautionary tale to keep in mind these days?
Well, I think, yes, I do think there is. I'm open to ideas as long as we do something. You know, right now, our bridges are crumbling. Our waterworks, our basic infrastructure is collapsing. You know, many cities, especially in the eastern half of the U.S., the water pipes, literally the lifeblood of a city. Especially in the older eastern coast cities, the water mains are over 100 years old. In a lot of them, including New York City, one of our main water tunnels is the only. They think they can't shut it off to inspect it because they think the only thing that's holding it up is the actual water pressure of the tunnel.
Wow.
In fact, New York City, we lose 1 billion gallons of water a day due to leakage.
Wow.
And in other cities, it's proportionate, you know, because these pipes are old. They haven't been replaced. People have put it out of sight, literally out of sight, out of mind. And that's the way the dam at the Connemara River was. We don't need to worry about a valve. We don't need to worry about releasing water. We got a cutout at the top, a spillway. That's enough. No, it wasn't, unfortunately.
Before we get into the human errors that contributed to the disaster, I want to start by asking you about the natural components involved. Talk a little about the sudden rainfall and maybe the topography of the area that also played into it.
Well, you know, you're
kind of created a perfect storm or a perfect flood, as if you
it
will.
It really was. I mean, you had a supply, which was a rainfall of over a foot or more, falling in a 12-hour period. And then you had the topography, the geography of that valley that came almost narrowed down to a point, with Johnstown being at the end of that, kind of a funnel almost, if you will. And so once you had the failure of the dam, 20 million tons of water started rushing into that valley. The lake emptied out in about an hour. And so it was estimated that the water was traveling at about 40 miles per hour, faster at some points, especially as it got toward the bottom of the valley. A wall of water of about 40 feet high. That's four stories. And as this as it was called, an unleashed monster was released, as it picked up steam and momentum, it was taking everything out in its path. Three other towns were wiped out before it got to Johnstown. Iron foundries, steel mills, barbed wire factory, railroads were wiped off the face of the earth and kept in this maelstrom of water. So that in this water, you had molten iron ore, you had locomotives, you had barbed wire, you had the contents of people's homes and businesses, all roaring down the valley. People said it sounded like 100 freight trains.
Wow. Oh, my God. That's horrible. In fact, I think one of the witnesses said that he couldn't even see the water. He said it looked more like a rolling mountainside.
Yeah, because there was so much debris in it. It was taking out trees. It was taking out boulders. It was stripping the landscape completely bare. So this is it's really hard to imagine watching something like this, as some folks were able to get out of the way. And there were tremendous acts of heroism. A number of telegraph operators sacrificed their lives, staying on their posts, even though they knew what was coming. And the problem was, once it was sent down the line, the telegraphs were sent down the line, the messages down the line, you know, it was too late. People couldn't evacuate in time. When, as the water started to rise, they thought, because there was so much flooding going on, they took it as kind of a playful sort of situation. Let's, you know, oh, look, there's water running in the streets. Let's play. And then it kept rising and kept rising. And then word came out that the dam had given way. And then panic ensued.
You say that the president of the Hunting and Fishing Club, Elias Unger, tried to send telegrams downstream, but for whatever reason, I don't know if they fell on deaf ears or they didn't get to the right people. Why wasn't there more of an evacuation? Because there was some notice, right?
Well, there was notice, but there were conflicting reports. Was this going to be something that was going to be catastrophic? Was it going to be a small flood? You know, the idea that the concept of the dam completely failing was so foreign to people that I don't think they believed it. They thought that it was a partial collapse, it was a problem, but nothing that couldn't be handled.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Al Roker when we come back in just a minute. Hey, folks, let me tell you about a company I love. We use them for our 800 number. And if you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, you really need to know about Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from their huge inventory of local, toll-free, and vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out running errands, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding to make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. We talked a little bit about the South Fork Hunting and Fishing Club. They were the ones that were in charge of the dam. Who were they? There were some pretty big guys involved in this club, right?
Yes. I mean, Andrew Carnegie was one of them. Henry Clay Frick. They were multimillionaires. They were the 1% of their day, of the Gilded Age. And after the disaster was over, there were about 60 members of the club. Fewer than half, a little more than half, donated to some relief fund. But the money that was donated was just laughable. And a number of people who lost everything, families, property, their homes, tried suing. But the legal recourse was almost impossible to pursue. And so laws were changed after this because of the Johnstown flood.
Yeah, eventually it led to some groundbreaking changes in our liability laws, right? Yeah. What changed there?
Well, the idea that, you know, you're responsible for your actions, that, you know, if you create something that causes great damage, you're going to have to pay a price. And, there were other changes in that some of the city fathers decided, you know, in this time of need— instead of when they rebuilt the streetcar system, instead of people being charged, it was free. It became a number of people, you know, had a change of heart as far as capitalism as opposed to being a little more progressive.
Yeah, all of this happened at the height of the Gilded Age and involved some of the wealthiest tycoons in the country, including, as you mentioned, Henry Frick, who Today, people might know him from the Frick Collection in New York, but he was not a particularly nice guy.
No, right? And a lot of them weren't. And that's why they were philanthropists. Yeah. They used philanthropy to paper over some of their flaws.
Now, what were the actual structural changes that the South Fork Club made to the dam that compromised the structural integrity and led to this flood?
Well, one of the main things, originally the dam had a release valve that you could control the amount of water that was in there and systematically lessen pressure on the walls and avoid overtopping, which for an earthen dam can be catastrophic because it slowly wears away the outer shell, if you will, the covering of that dam, exposing the rock and brick and whatever they used underneath. And once that continues, it erodes the integrity of the dam itself. So if they had had a valve and put it back and reinstated it, they could have released water in a controlled instance. At the top, they had a spillway, but it was partially blocked by it's not enough that we have a lake. We need fish in there. And so they stocked the lake with thousands of pounds of bass and other lake fish. But to keep the fish from escaping through the spillway, they blocked the spillway with a contraption of chains and logs. Well, when there was too much water, it was and there started to be some erosion on the shorelines and branches and larger branches were coming into the spillway that was blocking the spillway. So the amount of water that could come out was lessened even more.
Now, when the rain started falling in 1889, did they make an effort to clear those spillways or to shore up the dam happening?
It wasn't until literally a couple of hours before they realized the enormity of their problem that they try to clear it. But because of the pressure of the water and all the debris that was pushed up against it, they couldn't move the barricade.
And as if the flood wasn't bad enough, you have all this debris hurtling at people. In some cases, you have people who drowned because they got caught up in barbed wire that came downstream from the factory there.
And environmentally, this was a poisonous stew that was left behind once the water finally receded, because you had all kinds of chemicals and iron ore and all sorts of stuff in the water that then when it receded, it left this thick muck of toxic material behind. This was, I mean, and not to be too grim about this, but not only was there debris, but there were thousands of bodies. You know, I mean, it was perhaps the closest thing you could come to a living hell on earth.
Just in terms of numbers, at the end of the day, how much damage was done? How many people died? How long did the recovery take?
Well, right now the estimate is about 2,200, but there have been estimates as high as 5,000. In today's dollars, it would be about $17 billion in damage. And the reconstruction moved fairly quickly. It took a few years, but these businesses came back. The homes came back, but the topography of the valley was changed forever. Topsoil washed away, and a lot of vegetation still hasn't come back.
Yeah, I assume that you've probably, in your research, visited these areas, the South Fork Hunting and Fishing Club, the old factory in Johnstown. What do these areas look like today?
You know, today you probably wouldn't even know what had happened. It is it's an interesting juxtaposition in that here you had these gentlemen who wanted the good outdoor life at all costs, which they unfortunately the people of that valley paid the cost. And today, you know, there's a move afoot to get out into nature, but to try to leave less of a footprint and to work with nature as opposed to work against it. And that makes a big difference, I think.
Another curious incident during the flood was there was this stone bridge crossing the river at Johnstown. And in the middle of this, The bridge catches fire. I want to say something like 80 or so people died just from the fire. Yeah. I had to wonder, it would seem to me that everything would be too soaked to catch on fire.
Well, the problem was you had oil, you had fuel, all of a sudden, and a lot of the bridges were constructed of creosote-soaked timbers. And then you literally had fire, you had molten ore and flames, ignited the bridge. It seemed like the world was on fire. The entire world was on fire because there was an oil slick across the surface of the water, and that caught fire.
Jeez. And how long did the recovery and cleanup take?
It took, the initial cleanup took over a year. But even 5 years down the line, they were still working on rebuilding the town.
We mentioned earlier Clara Barton, the founder of American Red Cross. Didn't she spend something like 5 months leading the relief effort there?
Yeah, and nonstop. And wow. It was one of those events that she was in the right place at the right time, and it catapulted the Red Cross into the premier relief organization, not just in the country, but in the world, because she was prepared to, because she was kind of dismissed as a woman, that allowed her to operate around the margins and then eventually get right into the thick of things. But nobody really expected much of her, so they kind of ignored her. And next thing they knew, she had turned around and organized community tents, hospitals, banks, homes, shopping areas. She really and her staff did an amazing job. They rose to that occasion. And ironically, she was about to retire in 1900 when William Randolph Hearst wrote a huge check and wanted her to lead the relief effort for Galveston.
Yeah.
Not so much out of altruistic endeavors, but, to sell papers.
There was also a huge investigation into the dam break by, I think, the American Society of Civil Engineers, headed up by James Francis.
Yes.
What did they eventually determine? If it hadn't been for the human errors, would it still have been as bad? Would the dam have even been breached?
The dam probably, if it had been redesigned and designed properly, it most likely would have held. There could have been some partial failures around the top, but because of these egregious errors in redesigning the dam, and you add to that literally biblical proportions of rain, it was bound to fail. Now, if we hadn't gotten all that rain, might it have failed in 5 years, or 10 years, or 15 years? We won't know. But generally speaking, the consensus was this was a disaster that could have been avoided.
What was the public reaction like? Was this used as a rallying cry against the so-called robber barons and income inequality?
There was outrage. People were outraged. But, the people who were in pulling the levers of power were able to, in a way, quash it. Liability laws were changed because of this, because while there were some more than 60 members of this club, fewer than half, or a little more than half, donated to the relief fund for the townspeople, many donating nothing. And when folks tried to sue, they lost. Because the law was not on their side. And when you look at some of the lawsuits and what they were asking, I mean, these are folks who lost everything. Besides family members, they lost all their belongings. They're looking for a few $1,000 or $2,000, which was, back in the day, a lot of money, but still.
Yeah.
And nothing. They lost. It was too hard to prove.
Yeah, didn't they lose because there was some kind of a definition of liability where if the people weren't directly involved or didn't intentionally try to breach the dam or harm someone, there was no such thing as general negligence, I guess, or something like that?
Yeah, and they changed that. They got Congress to change that before too long, because the outrage, I mean, this was really a natural disaster or a disaster that happened just as newspapers rose to the position of influence because of the power of photography and the power of the word and the ability to disseminate their papers on a much wider scale. It was really the first time the country came together and experienced a natural disaster. Look, the Civil War had just ended not too far before that. But this was a different story.
Yeah, and it's an amazing story at that, albeit a little bit of a depressing one.
Yes.
Before we go, how about we wrap up on a slightly happier note then? It's barbecue season, and Al, I know that you have quite the reputation as a grill master. As a Texan, I'm a little hesitant to solicit barbecue advice from a New Yorker, but what the hell? How about giving us a few of your best barbecue tips?
Well, and again, I preface this by saying, in this country, we tend to confuse the terms barbecue and grilling.
Yes.
Barbecue is, as you, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, Ben, that barbecue is actually indirect heat. It's low. It's slow. Mm-hmm. Grilling is a direct heat. It's much quicker. But the words have kind of become interchanged. That said, I love nothing more simple than a great I usually make my hamburgers out of brisket.
Ooh, wow. That's
and
good.
It's a simple pleasure.
Hamburgers out of brisket. I don't think I've ever had that. Does it taste different than a barbecue beef sandwich?
It's a little, the flavor's a little more intense. Ask your butcher to grind you up a half and half mix of chuck and that brisket.
Wow.
You will thank me for it. You're going to kiss me full on the lips.
That's amazing. I think my best tip is don't drink and barbecue, and I have the burns to prove it, too.
My other tip would be just resist taking your spatula and pressing down on your hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
It dries out the meat because it presses, literally presses the juices out of the meat. Don't do that.
Okay. Well, once more, the book is called Ruthless Tide, The Heroes and Villains of the Johnstown Flood, America's Astonishing Gilded Age Disaster. And you can catch Al Roker weekday mornings on NBC's Today Show. Al, thanks for talking with me. It was fun.
Thanks, Ben. I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Al Roker for coming on the podcast. Order his book, Ruthless Tide, on Amazon or Audible. Catch Al weekdays on NBC's Today Show, check out his website at alroker.com, and follow him on Twitter at @AlRoker. I also want to remind you to check out adiamore.com/kick for a huge selection of diamonds and jewelry. When I recently decided to pop the question, I shopped around, but no one beat adiamore.com for the best price and the very best quality. All of Adia Moore's diamonds are GIA certified, and their rings come with a lifetime guarantee against material defects. Plus, Adia Moore gives you 30 days to evaluate the deal and make sure that you're 100% happy with your purchase. That's because the folks at Adia Moore know that once you find a jeweler you can trust, you've got a jeweler for life and you'll keep coming back year after year. So do yourself a favor. If you're shopping for an engagement ring or a gift, even if you think you're going to go somewhere else, before you make that big decision, you owe it to yourself to click on adiamore.com/kick, look at their selection and compare. That's adiamore.com/kick. adiamore.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.